today how major hotel chains such as the Holiday Inn and Ibis have been used to house rough sleepers during the COVID crisis.
You go inside, it looks tidy, very, very friendly staff at reception, helping people out if they've lost their room key, wearing the same normal uniforms with their name badges.
The Guardian's Amelia Gentleman has just walked into a hotel in central London.
There are signs when you look a bit more closely that things aren't operating quite as you would expect. On the reception counter, all of the spare key cards are sitting in this container full of antibacterial liquid. And then the bar area has been closed off and the beer taps have been wrapped up in cellophane to stop anybody, I suppose, from trying to use them. There's also a lot of security outside the hotel, much more than you'd normally expect.
The reason that things feel different is because this hotel has a new role in the middle of the coronavirus crisis. Like dozens of others, it is now providing a place where rough sleepers can be protected from the disease. When COVID-19 first hit Britain, it quickly became clear that this group, exposed on the streets and often with complex health conditions, would be among the most vulnerable. So at the end of March, ministers instructed councils in England and Wales to house everyone they could find, no questions asked.
And it was kind of extraordinary, given that we've been seeing how councils have been struggling with a rise in rough sleeping for years. This idea that suddenly you could get a directive from the government telling local authorities just to fix the problem within the space of 48 hours.
For many charities, this was an unexpected window of opportunity to reach people in dire need and help turn their lives around. But 2 months in, continued funding is now in doubt and there are fears about the scheme being wound down. From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, how the coronavirus crisis brought rough sleepers indoors. You've reported a lot from homeless shelters over the years. How different did it feel going into a hotel that tourists normally pay over £100 a night to stay in?
It was really, really lovely to go into the hotel. I think the most striking thing was how totally calm it felt and how entirely normal.
8 and 6.
Yeah. I went with the St Mungo's staff around the hotel corridors at lunchtime as they delivered food packages to residents.
Hi, lunch. Hello. How are you?
And they used this opportunity of handing the food in through the door of the rooms to check on people and to make sure that everybody is doing all right.
Who did you meet there?
Yeah, I'm just writing a piece about the whole project.
We sat and we talked to Claire, who is 39, from Bradford.
I'll be honest, I've been in the system all my life, kids' homes, secure units, hospitals, prisons,
He's been homeless for 15 months.
Where had she been living?
She had been living for a long time in the underpass of Charing Cross Station. She said it was a really unhygienic place and she felt very unsafe there.
But for the first month, I was just going into, McDonald's and getting an hour in the corner or in a train station. And
what do you mean, getting an hour?
An hour's sleep, because it ain't easy to get in a sleeping bag and sleep on a pavement.
She'd also spent some time living by herself in Soho.
So when the COVID lockdown was announced, were you rough sleeping then?
I was rough sleeping and they came round, the street link came round.
So whereabouts were you?
I was in Soho, Wardour Street.
Wow, so in a place where commuters are kind of racing to get their trains home, or a place where people are going for a night out in theatres or bars, Claire was living outside. How did it feel for her when she first went to the hotel?
She found it really difficult to begin with. She said for the first few nights, she felt scared inside the room.
I couldn't sleep with the light off. This might sound mad, but I was a bit scared. It was different, you know, when you get used to sleeping out in the open outside, and then all of a sudden you're in a bed in a room with a door that shuts. Yeah.
But obviously, by the time I met her, she'd been there for a few weeks and had settled in and was really enjoying herself.
So what is the best thing about the staying in the hotel?
To actually sleep in a bed and feel safe and feel I've got support. You know, can go and knock on the office door at any time, even if it's just to chat to somebody.
She had begun to eat properly for the first time in years. She said that when she arrived at the hotel, she only weighed 6.5 stone, but was beginning to eat properly and to put on weight. And she looked really well. And she was very relieved, I suppose, to have been helped by St. Mungo's.
And they've helped me with everything they possibly can. I couldn't, and that's no exaggeration, right down to my benefits, a doctor, birth certificate.
You did not have a birth certificate?
No, I had no ID.
So she felt like that this was a period where she could get some really constructive things done that might have a positive longer-term impact on her life.
There were clearly a lot of charity workers supporting people there, but were the hotel staff still working?
So the staff manning the reception are the normal staff. They appear to be finding it pretty straightforward to have a completely different clientele. They were being very helpful. The guests were behaving just as anybody would behave staying in a hotel. And that was something that was kind of really remarked on by the homelessness charities who were helping to organise all of this. I mean, that what they said is kind of course, you know, if you give people a lovely place to stay, everyone's going to be happy. They hadn't seen many of the problems that you might have anticipated. And that's not to say that it has been totally smooth. In some hotels, some rough sleepers have been asked to leave after problems around smoking inside rooms. But on the whole, I think everybody's been surprised at how little that's happened.
And has this been quite a calm place to you?
Yeah, it's been, yeah.
So at night time, there's no noise?
No, I mean, on my landing, it's very quiet. There's no trouble. There's no bother. Mm. Yeah.
And what are you watching on television?
Oh, a lot of films. Yeah.
Have you seen anything good?
I watched Jurassic Park for the first time, which was, I mean, things like that, just watching TV again, you know?
So for Claire and other residents coming to the hotel, this wasn't just about putting a roof over their heads and keeping them away from COVID, but also an opportunity for charities to help with all the other difficult things in their lives.
I think that this is why it's such an interesting experiment, because it's clear that this whole exercise wasn't driven by a government idea that you could suddenly solve homelessness. It was driven by a sense that you needed to get everybody into a place where they could self-isolate. But the charities who've been trying to tackle rising homelessness for years have seized on this moment as a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to try and stop large numbers of those who've been brought into hotels from leaving those hotels at the end of lockdown and returning to the streets. And there is a kind of cautious amount of optimism amongst charity workers that this could actually be possible for some people, for a proportion of those brought inside. It's really important not to be too rosy-eyed about how easy this is going to be, particularly given how completely shrunken the services available to people have become in the last decade.
Coming up, Amelia heads out to the streets to speak to those who haven't been given shelter within a hotel. The government says 90% of rough sleepers are in hotels paid for by the state getting this support. Is that right?
I don't think it's 90%. I think it's absolutely clear that 5,400 have been housed, that something like 1,400 have been given hotel rooms in London. And this is kind of undeniably a huge number. But I'm not sure that all of the homelessness charities agree with that. And certainly from the evidence of walking around London over the last few weeks, it's clear that there are lots and lots of people who remain outside on the streets. And even somebody from the mayor's office in London has acknowledged that in a recent count of people who are still on the streets in London, a month after this hotel exercise began, there were still almost 500 people in doorways, sleeping in sleeping bags. But still, you know, 5,400 people in hotel rooms is not an insignificant achievement.
Did you meet people who had fallen through the cracks, who were not inside hotels?
When you walk through Trafalgar Square and central London at the moment, it's clear that there are large numbers of people who haven't been helped into hotels, a place which is normally so crowded that it's hard to kind of make your way across the pavement. It's now pretty much deserted, apart from an area of steps just in front of the National Gallery, where you'd normally have groups of school children, groups of tourists. But sitting on those steps at the moment, every evening you see dozens and dozens of rough sleepers who are waiting there for food distribution.
Hi, my name is Brian. I'm one of the team leaders and volunteer for Under One Sky.
And how many people are you expecting to feed tonight?
Well, I have hot meals. I've got 70. I've got 80 sandwiches. Probably tonight, on average, I'd say we'll meet 120. We'll feed, give tea, we'll service 110.
It's a really unusual scene because there's no access to food throughout central London for people who are rough sleeping. I think you have to remember that normally, if you're homeless, you will have a bit of your own money. You'd probably be able to go to cafes to buy food. There are lots of different ways that you can kind of look after yourself. But no one's around to give you a bit of money or a bit of food by the tube stations. There aren't any loos that you can use. All of the kind of day centres, which might previously have provided essential services to homeless people, are shut down.
It must have been a strange reporting trip out in PPE, trying to talk to people from 2 metres away. Who did you meet?
We spent quite a bit of time there talking to groups of people who came to see if they could get an evening meal from the charity. And I think the thing that I was most startled by was the new homeless people.
And did you stop work because of COVID?
Yeah, I stopped because of COVID.
So when did you lose your job?
I spoke to a man called Martin, who is somebody who's been in Britain for about 5 years and was quite a senior chef in a very fashionable East London restaurant just before lockdown began. And he lost his job very quickly, I think a couple of weeks before the lockdown was formally announced, but at a time when it was already clear to owners of restaurants that things were going to be very, very difficult for their business. Because he lost his job, he couldn't pay his rent, and so he is now sleeping on the streets near Charing Cross.
The street is no one is safe.
And he was really, really hoping to be housed by the government in one of these hotels. Although he'd been promised it a number of times by charity representatives, by outreach workers, he was still waiting.
Okay, so this isn't a magic bullet, and clearly all over London, but also all over the country, there are still people, rough sleepers, suffering in the middle of this crisis. But it does sound to me like there are some incredibly positive things we can take from this. For a start, it shows what is possible. And it really reminds me of speaking to our colleagues, Simon Hattonstone and Danny Lavelle last year about their amazing series on homeless deaths. One policy idea that Simon said stood out above all others as he went around the country looking at issues of homelessness was one known as Housing First, basically getting people into accommodation without any conditions attached before piecing together the jigsaw of their other needs. Isn't that principle at the heart of what you were witnessing in this hotel?
That's absolutely what the charity workers are trying to do with people when they've got them in the safe space for the period of a few months. They really are hoping that lockdown continues for at least another 2 months so that they've got time to work with people.
I would say that these hotels have been a very interesting social experiment.
I met a nurse working at the hotel called Samantha Dorney-Smith, and she made the point that it is extraordinary that if you give people what they want, they make the right decisions. And she was very, very happy to be able to work with people who have for years been very hard to get to come in for consultations. She'd been getting people GP services.
You know, eye problems, musculoskeletal problems, undiagnosed high blood pressure, those kind of things.
She'd been getting people access to mental health services in a way that has been extremely hard for years. She also said that the scheme had been remarkably successful in keeping the number of COVID cases very, very low.
They have been given, you know, the correct facilities and service and really good support to stay in and to, you know, and to socially distance and stuff like that. So I think that probably has saved a lot of lives, and what we've seen is...
But already there is worry about this scheme, even while the COVID-19 crisis continues. The government told councils to initially pay for it out of exceptional funding to respond to coronavirus that was given in two £1.6 billion payments. But controversially, Elite now suggests that's it. They want councils to carry on, but they're going to have to fund it themselves without extra resource. And also, beyond that, this is a response to COVID. So we don't know if there's any political will to carry on with all the positive things that you're seeing as the lockdown lifts. Is it hard to be optimistic about this carrying on?
It's so difficult because, of course, there are reasons to be optimistic. But the woman in charge of the hotel I visited is a woman called Bethan Epps, who works for St Mungo's. And she describes her kind of fluctuating optimism, because on the one hand, you can help people. You can help people to fill in applications for housing, for private rented places that they might move on to. But you still have to be pretty realistic about the complete unaffordability of most housing in London or around London if you're going to be reliant on universal credit and housing benefit support. So it's a positive start, but the structural problems outside of the hotels are so massive that you can't really see any prospect of a long-term solution for these people who've been brought in for the COVID period, unless there is a government decision to throw even more money at the problem. And that money needs to be thrown at the services, which have all dried up in the last decade, and it needs to be pushed into a more generous local housing allowance so that people are able to afford to rent properties.
How did Claire, who you met in the hotel, feel about this? Was she worried about her future?
So when this is done, you know, it's about finding accommodation for everybody. And that is one of my worries, is that as much as they're saying to us, you know, we'll do what we can to put you in accommodation, it's about whether there's vacancies.
It was clear that she and all of the other residents in the hotel were beginning to watch the news with kind of growing anxiety and were really listening out for any news about when lockdown might end and what that might mean for them.
If there's no accommodation sorted for me, then I'd be back out on the streets. It's as simple as that, I would be back out on the street.
So an enormous amount of kind of bubbling under anxiety about what's going to happen next.
Amelia Gentleman, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Amelia Gentleman, who has written some really powerful pieces on homelessness during the COVID crisis and the government's Everyone In scheme. Do look them up at theguardian.com. I also mentioned the reporting of Simon Hattonstone and Danny Lavelle last year, writing about the lives of rough sleepers who had sadly died. If you haven't read their series, then I strongly recommend it. And do listen to Simon and Danny on Today in Focus. Search for The Empty Doorway, the people behind Britain's homeless statistics. That's it for today. My thanks to Amelia Gentleman and to all the charities involved in her reporting, and to Claire and Martin and the other people who spoke to her. This episode was produced by Elizabeth Cassin. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. We'll be back tomorrow.